Welcome to Open Source. It's Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. Sorry, I thought we all had to talk like that now. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico, and joining me is...
I'm Scotty Hertz. And either I'm a liar or confused or mostly confused or just a confused liar.
I think that's an alternative fact.
I think I'm just confused.
This is not an alternative fact, though. Open Source
Absolutely
is a
not.
CFRU's political and current affairs discussion show, and you can listen to us live here on CFRU every Thursday at 5 p.m. You can also listen to us live online. Just go to CFRU.ca and click on the Listen Now icon at the top right-hand corner of your screen. And you can listen to us anytime by downloading the Open Sources podcast from Podbean on the Guelph Politicast channel, or you can subscribe through iTunes. Today we will talk about the fallout of the first week of the new U.S. administration from the Canadian point of view. It seems that Canada's trade relationship with America may be secure, and Keystone may now be all systems go, but might Trump turn on us, as a former Mexican congressman has said? And then we will talk about the last year in First Nations issues with Métis writer and activist Paul Smith. Obviously, with pipelines a go, there's some serious stuff ahead for our Aboriginal friends to deal with, but things are not completely terrible and oppressive, as Paul will hopefully tell us in the second half of the show. But first, we got to talk about the first week of President Trump. President Trump.
Still feels weird saying that.
It's so weird.
I don't think you'll ever get used to it.
It's like, you know, you just call him Trump. It's just like one word. It's like if Cher
it's
were
Brent.
To be.
He's a Brent.
Or Adele were to be president. It's just Adele
probably
yeah.
should be president, but anyway. In my world.
Yeah.
Or at least prime minister. Yeah, but.
So where do we begin? There was the four-day battle about how big his crowds were. There was talking about his war with the media in front of a CIA memorial wall. He was talking about the millions of illegal voters who somehow voted for his opponent but couldn't muster up enough fake votes to actually deliver them a victory. And then there was all the terrible stuff he signed on executive orders. It's like really overwhelming because there's like all this like, well, I'm going to say it's not so serious stuff. Even I think it's all serious, but I mean, there's the blank show stuff, the S word blank show stuff, like this, like stuff about, you know, voters and illegal voters and, how big my crowds are and this sort of thing and alternative facts. And then there's like the really serious stuff, like, you know, all these executive orders he's signing about, you know, reinstituting the gag rule, the Mexico rule about not giving money to people or organizations that talk about abortion overseas, and, you know, all these things about building the wall and starting that process and all these other disgusting things. But
and that's not even the end of the list. I think the guy's going to need like an electric pen maybe to sign stuff. He signed so much stuff in the past few days. Like, it hasn't even been a week yet.
No.
And he's put his name to all kinds of things. So a lot to filter out. You can see why we gave him the Lifetime Achievement Award on our award show, because we knew he was going to earn it, unlike Obama's Peace Prize. We knew that Obama. He's gone. We knew Trump.
he's gone.
He's on a vacation. He's relaxing somewhere. Icon, like, I guess. I saw the picture. I don't know what island that was, but man, I was like, talk about jealous. But anyway, so the humming and hawing about the size of the crowd, that's not even the most disturbing part. I've mentioned this online too. What is weird about Trump when he does this is he puts on the little voice. He does his voice. It was like I looked out and I saw all these people. And I'm not doing that just to impersonate him, but that is unnerving to me. It's like, you know, president of the free world, as they say, and he has to talk in this kind of like baby voice to kind of validate what he's saying, or at least try to. Executive orders galore. A little bit. I think he's out of control with the pen, actually. I mean, he's out of control in general, in my view, but I don't know where to start.
I don't know.
I locked up there because I'm overwhelmed. Honestly, you listed 10 things. I'm trying to pick one. It's
one
like,
of the one of the latest developments today was that because of the wall action, Enrique Peña Nieto, who's the president of Mexico, pulled out of a planned meeting with Trump next week. So and then Trump gets up at the at a meeting retreat they're having, the Republican caucus, the congressional caucus, and he gets up and says, "Because I'm building the wall, Mexico agreed that, and I agreed that we shouldn't have the meeting next week." And it's like, no, you didn't. Mexico is not wanting to pay for your stupid wall, which is wholly impractical and completely pointless and is merely symbolic. And you know, it's. This is something of one of your little delusions, and you know Mexico's not going to help you along with it by engaging in even the appearance that they want to maybe give you the money to build the wall.
And yeah, it's his response to everything is an alternative fact. he's getting his information from alternative facts, whether it's the amount of people that voted that shouldn't have, or voted twice, or dead people voting. His source for that is. His source, whatever it is. We're not sure where he's getting that from. Well, we know where he's getting it from, the internet, obviously. But, yeah, and the announcement this afternoon, I'm trying to keep up with this stuff on coffee break and whatever, the plan is to put a 20% tariff on all Mexican goods, or at least discuss that possibility, which is supposedly going to pay for the wall. But, of course, I think under NAFTA right now, they couldn't do that. It's just not possible. So, of course, the redrawing of that will possibly lead to this. Would it even happen? Is he just talking, which seems to be the plan? Something else that came out this afternoon, too, is that the entire senior management of the State Department resigned.
Yeah.
Dropped that on Rex Tillerson's lap. It's like, sorry, we're the new Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson.
He's not even Secretary of State yet. I don't think he's even out of committee yet.
Oh,
or maybe
goodness.
He's out of committee. It hasn't been voted for by the full Senate yet. But
so he's going to have to redraw those lines pretty, well, I would think pretty darn quick. But
yeah, but you know what? The Trump supporters aren't going to care about that, because that's going to fall into the draining the swamp paradigm. You know, oh, we're going to lose some senior managers. Boo-hoo, we're draining the swamp anyway. And so that's not going to like upset them too much. It's probably definitely going to upset the established order in terms of how relations are handled at the State Department, because you're not just losing people. The deputy whose name escapes me at the moment, you know, he's been a part of the last two administrations, so he's fairly well versed on current U.S. diplomatic policy, and you can put someone in his position, but you can't replace that kind of institutional knowledge. And like a lot of civil service positions, you have people at the State Department who it doesn't matter to them who is president, because they're not political staff. They're political staff, but they're not partisan staff. You know, they're not appointed by whoever's president. So they're there regardless. And the fact that, you know, after one meeting with Tillerson, because that's what prompted it, is Tillerson was at the State Department yesterday afternoon having meetings with people getting up to speed. And then that meeting's over, and then all of a sudden, you have no more senior staff in the State Department. It's like, yeah, I wonder what happened.
I can't work for this guy. It's time to check out. So and it'll be like, the pensions are too high. Well, let's cut those too. Who knows?
there are a lot of sort of little things crawling around the edges. One of them is Alex Jones, and so you have to judge the source. Oh. But Alex Jones says that he's been offered press accreditation for the White House for Infowars.com, which I take with a grain of salt, but it would not surprise me if that were true, because yeah.
Well, there goes every press conference from now until 4 years from now.
Is it true that the government holds covering up the UFOs in Area 51? When is the UFOs coming to kill us all? Infowars.com.
I don't know. It just...
That was beautiful. His face wasn't lobstery enough to me. And I love the remixes of Alex, like supposedly head of a metal band or something.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's what we're going to see there, because he'll get every first and second question, probably.
But more disturbing to me, anyway, is this idea.
No.
No, but the most disturbing is these reports coming out, and like the White House has sprung a leak. You have never seen leaks like this. To use a Trump anachronism, you've never seen leaks from the White House like this.
It's the greatest leak the White House has ever
seen. Well, it's true, because you have people telling like the Washington Post and the New York Times that, and I want to find the quote I wrote down here.
It wasn't about the fist fights, was it?
And it wasn't about fist fights.
Fist fights at the inaugural ball. It's like, really?
No, it wasn't about... Oh, I can't find the quote, but it's about basically that everyone's concerned about the temperament of Trump because basically he gets they have to control information that might infuriate him. So already we have a 70-year-old man who you can't tick off. You give him bad news. And I hate to say it, but when you're president of the United States, chances are most of the news you're going to get is bad. So they have to walk around eggshells with him. And then when they're not walking around eggshells, he basically gets bored easy and, you know, goes and watches cable news.
Mm.
And you don't need any more proof of this, but then... Except what happened the other night where Bill O'Reilly is doing his opening monologue riff thing where he's talking about the murder rate in Chicago and how it's not a great situation in Chicago.
Hasn't been for a long time, but yeah.
And then Trump goes online on Twitter like 15 minutes after the fact and is like, well, I'm going to, you know, the mayor of Chicago better, I'm paraphrasing, the mayor of Chicago better get, you know, his stuff in line or else I'm going to be sending in the feds to deal with this carnage in quote marks. And so you have basically, have Bill O'Reilly having a meeting with the president of the United States where
on
he's
TV,
getting policy yeah. ideas from a TV pundit commentator and not necessarily one of the better ones. So, I mean, this is kind of really troubling that you have this man who you can't tell anything bad to because he might go off his handle and he might order the press secretary to go out and deliver a bunch of nonsense in front of the press and call it, you know, a briefing. And then he'll go back and watch TV to see how it all went down. Meanwhile, the only work he seems to be doing is signing these things and doing these photo ops and taking part in these meetings. There's really no sign that he's actually learning anything because he had these. A lot of people made a big deal on Monday. Oh, he had like six meetings back to back, and he met with union leaders, which is a good thing. Met with automakers.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't.
Yeah.
I just saw the one where he met with the automakers and.
Yeah, and he met with automakers. He met with business people.
Reduce taxes.
Had like, yeah, working dinners and working breakfast, and that's all great. But when is he like sitting down with policy books? When is he having like briefings with senior staff? Is he doing those things? Because what it sounds like is they trot him out into the Oval Office where he signs some crap, and I do put the emphasis on crap.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes back and sees how it's all playing out on CNN, and then gets up a head of steam about it, and. That's not good.
No, definitely not. And all the signatures are for prepared things. Like I'm fairly sure these things are being handed to him. I don't know if it's his initiative. Maybe a little bit. He'll say,
"Well, the wall
hey,
is."
They say, "Hey, Trump." The wall is for sure. But they'll be like, "Hey, Trump, what about this?" Oh, that's great. Just give me the paper. I'll sign. Like I think that's what's going on. It's not that he's sitting down with the team and formulating stuff. I think the team are just. This is just my impression. That the team is just feeding him stuff, you know, get it written up and he'll go, oh, I'm signing this now and it's this and it's great. And that's troublesome because, you know, they could spoon feed him anything. It's like you say about, you know, see something on TV and it's like, oh, hey, I better act on that because it's on TV and this is talking about me and I want to fix this. And there's a lot going on there.
And it's the Grover Norquist fantasy, right? Because it was like, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, Grover Norquist gave this speech where he basically said, we just have to elect a Republican to be president. And then that way we can just shove whatever we want from the Republican Congress in his face and he'll sign it and we don't. Basically, he was looking for an empty suit. And that's what we've seen is happening. All of this like hardcore Republican boner stuff, like the global gag rule and like, shutting down, climate change and, shutting down engagement with the EPA and all these other things.
And the national parks that
Keystone, which we'll talk about in a minute. Yeah.
The Twitter war.
So, this is all, hardcore conservative stuff that I don't think Donald Trump ever gave a fig about.
No.
And so that's the one side of it. And then the other side of it is I forget what the other side of it was, but I think
there is no other side.
But I think Brian Stelter is like the media reporter at CNN. I think he had a really great idea, which is that cable news should be producing a program called Good Evening, Mr. Trump, which is a newscast for Trump. Where you can
he would love that.
Oh, I know. It would feed
right
into
all kinds
the
of stuff in there. Like. but Donald, it's just, climate change is actually real.
But if he's like that, like obsessive watching TV and doing the other things,
it's dangerous.
But I mean, if that's how you reach him, and certainly there's a case to be made that's how he's being reached, at least through Fox News.
Or on Twitter, right? You can tweet, you know, some poor kid can tweet about him. If he sees it, he'll be like, oh, I'm going to kill
him. I remember the other thing. He's somebody phrased this perfectly on a post I read where somebody responded like, well, that's what people like about Trump. He's a doer. He's doing things. And I'm like, great. Now we have Homer Simpson as president, because that was the line in the Cat Burglar episode where Homer gets up and says, we don't need a thinker. We need a doer, someone who will act without considering the consequences. And that's exactly what's happening. Like, it's the Homer Simpson presidency.
I think the Simpsons are deciding policy and deciding who gets elected, really.
I mean, it's bizarre. It's just bizarre. It's like, this is what we...
It reminds me very much of the Rob Ford days on this show and in previous shows where we were just like, the tidal wave hit us. And I think, I don't know, the Trump bit's going to probably be a regular thing each week. Unless...
The Trump bit.
Unless, you know, people say, no, can you shut up about Trump? Then we will. But
I didn't even want to talk about Trump this week.
No. It's a story like the first, what was that on the weekend? It was Trump, and then, the people were rescued from the avalanche. Like, that was in an hour and a quarter of watching the news channel that I watched, the only break was they got some people out of the avalanche. And then the next day it was Trump, and they got some dogs out of the avalanche. Like, that was all that was able to, three puppies. Anyway,
let's talk about what Canada thinks of Trump, because there was some good news. The government had its cabinet retreat. Everyone's having a retreat.
We need a retreat, Adam. Open sources retreat.
I don't disagree. Maybe after the show.
Yes, a hamburger retreat.
Yeah. with what's his face? Trudeau. Sorry, I forgot his name for a minute.
It also starts with true.
It's TNT. We got TNT on both sides of the border.
Truman.
But they had a cabinet retreat. They had someone who is not of the White House, but who's like an advisor to Trump, come up and say like, hey, it's not about Canada. It's about Mexico. So you guys
Schwartzman,
can chillax.
Right? Stephen
Schwartzman? That's right. Schwartzman.
Trump advisor. I see them all as mysterious. Obviously a businessman of note somewhere, right?
Right.
Made somebody a lot of money.
And then Keystone, Trump signed that executive order, and the Trudeau government was like, yeah, awesome. We're going to get some, you know, jobs going. That's going to help the oil patch. And Right on.
And Rachel Notley.
Rachel Notley. I think it was on CBC, somebody, or was CTV. I think it was maybe Craig Oliver, and then I'm thinking about it, I lied, but he said, it's funny how this was kind of like the priority for Stephen Harper for like a decade as he was in government, and for the conservative government in Alberta to try and get this going and get all these pipelines going.
Is he taking credit for it? He probably is.
Who?
Harper.
Yeah. I don't know.
He's laying low, I guess. He's staying out of the way.
Well, he did make a comment about Trump. Trump's like basically tearing down the paradigms of the United States. That was kind of like a brief statement. But Oliver's point was like, isn't it interesting that there's finally progress on this while we have a liberal federal government and NDP provincial government in Alberta? Mm-hmm. I think that's just maybe the times. But I think certainly...
A lot of jobs.
Well, it's a lot of construction jobs.
Well, was Trump's number 28,000? He just said that. Cannot confirm or deny whether that number is remotely accurate. He just said 28,000 jobs, as if that was a given. He could have said a million jobs. And everybody like, yay.
Well, right? it is a trend.
Job.
That's construction job. I mean, jobs are going to be very, very minimal once it's built, but that's going to
take... I heard 35 permanent positions.
Right, but that's... I mean, it's going to take years to get it built, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, having said that, you know, you'd think people in Alberta might be happy, but I saw a bit of that town hall with Trudeau in Calgary.
The one with the yelling? Where the guy took his red hat off. I couldn't see what it said. I couldn't see if it said "Make Canada Great Again" or whatever.
I would bet
he was very Canadian.
I would bet
taking
a dollar
his hat
and a quarter
off.
that was a "Make America" or "Make Canada Great Again" hat.
This is the guy I was alluding to off the top, who said, "Mr. Trudeau, you're either a liar or
a liar or a confused, and I think it's both."
He said, "I am a confused liar." No, I.
And Trudeau was like,
a little bit heated, I guess.
Come on, bro. Just chill. It's all good.
Bring it, dog. Yeah, that's what he said. He's wanting to be all street. Street
Trudeau.
Street
fighting man. I feel like we're becoming more bitter towards Trudeau.
I don't know about bitter, but you know, he's earned the critique.
Oh no, he's definitely earned critiques.
We shouldn't be too bitter because, you know, we are gunning to get him on the show. So,
well, he should do that anyway.
Open invite, well, yeah.
But I mean, a lot of people are I think understandably concerned, but about how Trump's trade policy will affect Canada. But you don't hear him talk about when he talks about NAFTA. He doesn't talk about Canada. He's talking about Mexico because
he really has it in for Mexico, doesn't he? It's like Mexico is a source of.
I have a feeling
he's okay with us, but Mexico.
I have a feeling that maybe the Mexican government like put the kibosh on some kind of Trump resort and in Baja or something.
Yeah, they slighted him somehow. Like maybe the gift when Trump went to see the president during the election, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe the gift they gave him wasn't enough or something. Because that's the kind of thing Trump gets bent about, right? It's not even... I mean, it is policy to a degree, but the things they get miffed about, a.k.a., you know, like the size of the crowd. It's like these are things that that pushes his button.
But it's interesting that, you know, that in talking about NAFTA, Canada seems like an afterthought. It's all about Mexico. And granted, the trade deficit difference between the United States and Mexico is very big. You know, we're kind of at trade parity, Canada and the U.S. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the exact number is, but it's fairly close.
Yeah, it's not it's many, many millions of deficit, isn't it?
It's like 20. It's like 60 billion or something.
60 billion.
So that's not insignificant.
No.
But, and I did find this interesting, but apparently if NAFTA is like put on hold or it's revoked or frozen or dismantled, apparently, the original free trade agreement between Canada and the U.S. is still in effect.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Well, I don't 100% know that, but that's what came from some of the reading I was doing.
It's entirely possible, because I think when they tack these things on, it's...
But, I mean...
Sort of like the EU setup, where it's like, here are the rules, but so-and-so gets an exception,
I think,
and whatever.
Yeah, I think the one thing, though, that Trudeau and company aren't going to care about is TPP. I mean, if... I don't think that's a done deal, but he signed the executive order to like pull out of TPP or to begin that process. And I think the rules were where if one party pulls out of TPP, it all falls apart.
Yeah, especially the U.S. But
yeah, so I don't
back to the drawing board.
I don't think anyone in the Trudeau government will be crying about that because
it's unpopular.
Well, it's pretty unpopular, and you know what? You need like an advanced postdoctoral degree in economics to even to even just get a basic
Freeland
sense of what's in
it. To be there and just give you the spiel.
Yeah, you need Krista.
Freeland seems to be on top of things.
Yeah, you need her to be sitting next to you, giving you like crib notes in order to even talk intelligently on it. But so, I mean, that's a plus, although people are pointing out that Trump has basically abdicated Pacific trade to China. To control, like, and he just like kind of threw it out completely rather than going back and making, wait for it, a great deal.
If I don't get a great deal,
yeah,
it's all over. Yeah, and there seems to be some military overtures going on there as well. Yeah, South China Sea and these fake islands China has built out of garbage or something. And they're going to defend. Well, it was like it's just along the demarcation line.
That does sound like something China would do.
Yeah. It's like, well, there's a little outcropping here. Let's just make it bigger. Kind of like those islands they built for Expo 67. No, not like that at all. Anyway, larger. It'll be bigger. Bigly. And going back to the pipelines, too, it sounds like Canada and the Liberals in particular, I don't know if it's because they were on the retreat, they didn't get any advance notice of the approval of the pipeline. It was just kind of like, oh, this is happening. So they obviously had to adapt
I think it's a memorandum, not a approval. It's like just saying we're going to be going forward with this because I believe Enbridge has to get its stuff together again to submit.
On the Canadian side or for the whole thing?
Probably for the whole thing because I think...
Well, and it connects to another pipeline as well, right? Maybe that's part of it too. So it's a straight shot from the tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico, which is full of BP oil.
Right, because, I mean, construction on parts of Keystone has been underway.
Yeah.
But they're...
2 kilometers, if I heard it right, 2K are done.
Yeah.
of the, what is it, 5,000?
Yeah.
2,000. So,
but I mean, it's you know, there is a lot of paperwork that has to be done. So, they're not going to be putting shovels on the ground.
But the wheels are in motion,
right?
As opposed to just humming and hawing about it. So, and it seems like we're going to meet our climate change goals while doing all of this somehow. I'm not sure how that's possible.
I don't know.
Trump's comment about that he's an environmentalist, but it's gone too far or something like that. It's like, I'm an environmentalist, but but it's out of control. I'm an environmentalist, like the next guy.
I don't know.
It's out of control.
Like so much Trump says, I don't know what that means. But
doublespeak, never mind alternative facts. This is like doublespeak is back. It's like, I'm an environmentalist, but we're going to stomp on the bears and the snowy owls.
Well, it's like that interview he did yesterday about the voter fraud, and we're kind of getting back on Trump rather than the Canada stuff. But I mean,
yeah, we don't.
You know, he's
Canada's
like,
going to duck and cover.
He just says these vague things and expects you to follow his line of thinking, like we're mind readers, and that's not.
Yeah, because when that discussion happens in a bar, somebody says, "Okay, stay with me here." You know, you get it. You know, but instead, he just goes, "Bow," and you're like.
It is like a discussion you have in a bar.
It is I think every discussion, it's not even a discussion. It's like the guy, you know, that guy in the bar who said too many of whatever and just starts talking. It's like, again, back to Saturday Night Live, the drunk uncle is probably more Trump-like than Alec Baldwin. Although Alec Baldwin is very good at what he does. I guess that's it. We're going to lose our license now, and Trump's going to tweet madly that those kids from Canada.
Open sources treated me very, very badly.
Yep. It's almost too easy. It really is. Like, you know, we could just have the Trump show every week. And
but seriously, I think some things to keep an eye on. One is the military commitments. We're still waiting to hear whether we're going to be sending peacekeepers. And they're saying one of the reasons we haven't heard about
that's stalled now, isn't it? It's on ice.
Yeah, because we're waiting to see what Trump's going to do with NATO and stuff. And if Putin decides he's going to go whole hog on Ukraine, it may fall upon NATO to the remains of NATO.
Yeah.
to do something about it. And then the other thing is us legalizing marijuana, because you have Jeff Sessions, who's saying he's going to be enforcing drug laws, and that's going to affect a lot of the handful of U.S. states that have legalized recreational marijuana.
I can't remember, man. Who's the other state?
California.
That's right.
Well, they have approved it. I don't think it's in effect yet. But yeah, plus a ton of states that have medicinal marijuana. But I mean, if Canada becomes a complete marijuana zone, like marijuana cool zone.
We're going to be a destination zone for marijuana, abortions, you name it. Hopefully not guns. I think that's something else that we're sort of holding out on.
Yes,
things that make us different. If we hear Trudeau or anybody higher up in Canadian government making the overtures, let's say, you know, you'll know we have completely sold out. I think in a lot of ways, Trump just kind of sees us as the 51st state, really.
Well, I think that's how a lot of
America does. But I think that's probably why we're not getting the heat that Mexico is, because it's just kind of like, well, they're like us, but they're nicer and they're more polite and
they
say sorry. And
although interestingly, the Trump Tower downtown Toronto will probably not be the Trump Tower this time next year. If it
it's
finds
done,
a buyer.
Isn't it? It's just it's falling apart.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
the Trump Tower downtown Toronto is a disaster. I'm taking my name off of it.
It's gonna be the Rogers Tower. That's my guess.
Ooh, maybe. That seems gross.
Mervish Tower.
Down the road from Rogers Center.
Hmm.
But whatever.
They just own everything.
Well, it's possible. Anyway.
But they don't own us, Donaldson.
That's right. Speaking of getting owned, we have to play some commercials of our own right now. And then we're going to play some music. And then I don't see him outside, but I'm sure Paul is here somewhere.
Paul, if you're out there, this is your 1 minute call.
Waiting to talk about Aboriginal stuff. Oh, he is waving. There we go.
Good stuff. He got the message. I love when that
happens. We will take a break and get Paul in here. You're listening to Open Sources Guelph here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
It's Steph.
I'm Jenna.
I'm Alvina.
I'm Ben, and we're hanging in the studio.
You're listening to CFRU 93.3 FM.
Like any girl from a small town, I wanted just to get away. So I crossed the ice road and swore I'd never come back this way. Years flew by in the city, lost its rosy.
And that was Lila Gilday from her album Heart of the People from our Indigenous library. And that song was called Safe Passage. Lila is from Yellowknife, and that album is from 2014. Way up in the NWT. Lovely voice.
Yeah, she's a great singer. Yeah. Great singer, actually. Yeah. I like her stuff.
And that is that voice.
Another great voice.
That voice is another, another great voice belongs to Paul Smith. He is a Métis writer and activist. And I will direct your attention, not right this minute, but when you get a sec after the show, Paul contributed a piece to The Ontarian last week. You can still find it on The Ontarian's website, theontarian.com, about what an interesting year it was for Aboriginal people and Indigenous people in Canada. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to have Paul expand a bit on that. But first, welcome, Paul. Welcome back to the show. I think this is the first time we've had you since we retooled.
Yeah, first time in the studio, at least.
Yes, yeah, so, yeah, you know, we did have you on the phone.
Going, yeah, I'm
disembodied, but you know, better to be embodied.
Well, that's right, you're on the phone.
Very true. But before we get into what happened last year, I wanted to get your thoughts on pipelines, because we were talking about that before the break.
It's been a pipeline show so far, right?
We've wanted to be on the pipeline, I think.
Should make the Ventures our theme song, theme music.
That's right. But, I mean, that's kind of the... I think where it's going to get really sticky between the government and Aboriginal communities coming up is these pipelines.
Sure.
There's a lot of give and take, and already Aboriginal communities are feeling a bit betrayed by Trudeau because he's perhaps not rubber stamped them, but has certainly not been fully or as hardcore about the actual engagement with the community as he said he would be.
Well, probably even more of concern is Dakota Access Pipeline, because I think, you know, the way Trump has kind of essentially told the Army Corps of Engineers to approve it, not go through some process to approve it, just to get on with it.
Ram it through, yeah.
He's a Nike president, yeah. Just do it.
So, and given what's happening there and the potential for that to be a flashpoint, I think that could be one of the early confrontations for Mr. Trump and his collective opposition. And it won't be pretty, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. It's already been ugly. It was 600 arrests just in the last couple of months there. Mm-hmm. And you don't hear about it. You don't hear about the mainstream media that much, really.
I had heard one report that they had pretty much telling everybody that was there to leave. And it was only days before these approvals.
Yeah.
So I guess I take it that that's changed. It's like all hands on deck, probably.
Yeah, I'm sure they're not sure what to do. But that was the council of the reservation there, because they're concerned about people down on the floodplain safety and then all the stuff they would leave there and it would all wash.
Especially this time of year, too.
Into the river and so on. So they were kind of thinking that way. But yeah, I think the game's changed now completely, right?
Mm-hmm. Is there lessons to be learned from, because that is an American... problem, but
it is. It's close to the Canadian border. So a lot of Canadian Indigenous people from Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta have gone down there. Hundreds of people have gone down there, and so it's a source of kind of become an icon for Indigenous people all over North America.
I do wonder though if it's been sort of become a practice run for Canadian Indigenous people in looking at what's going on.
Perhaps. Yeah, yeah. No, I think it has been a game changer in terms of getting the United Front, hundreds of Indigenous nations have endorsed what's going on there, and the flags are all flying there. So it is, in a sense, could be a trial run for what might happen on our side. I think, on the other hand, it does make Canada look, relatively... accommodating compared to the U.S., and I think that contrast will be evident, too. So I'm sure there will be confrontations around Kinder Morgan, Trans Mountain, and Line 3 as well. You know, Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs have filed court papers on the Line 3 and so on. So I think, but that's sort of, it's somewhat abstract because it's just a paper approval now.
Right.
Wait till the shovels are in the ground. That's probably a few years off anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Dakota Access is going to be imminent, right? It's probably within the next couple of months.
Yeah, I do think that to revisit something you just said, that I think Canada or those of us in Canada kind of rest on our laurels because we look at something like Dakota Access where it's like literally the bulldozers are coming towards the protesters mm-hmm. and then the President Obama steps in and goes like, hey guys, maybe we should rethink this. But, you know, we think because our Aboriginal communities go to court and they seem to have a voice, we seem to think that we're somewhat better on Aboriginal relations than Americans. And I suppose we are because we're not like bulldozing them down and arresting them by the hundreds, mm-hmm. but I do wonder, looking at the mess south of the border, if that doesn't sort of encourage us to say, you know, well, we're not doing so bad.
Well, I mean, I think it, you know, as I said in that article, there has been a big sea change in the last few years. And I think 2016 sort of encapsulated all the things that have been happening since 2013. You know, I don't know more. Precipitated in large part by Stephen Harper's animosity and intransigence to any change and, you know, watering down environmental laws. So he got a blast in, mm-hmm. with Idle No More. And then some of that contributed to his election defeat, too, that you know, and his mishandling of the, you know, Indigenous First Nations education file with Sean Atleo. That was such a disaster for him.
Right.
And now I think all that contributed, at least in small part, to the election defeat. You know, they'd never seen such turnout amongst First Nations and Métis people in the mm-hmm. in the North and the West. And they figure it might have tipped, you know, 20, 25 seats. Mm-hmm. But that the turnout was unprecedented.
Mm-hmm.
So, against you know who.
Oh, exactly. So, you know, your article, you'd indicated, you know, that we had some good, we had seen some developments like Truth and Reconciliation Commission and the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women's Inquiry. But in terms of the, I guess we'll call them meat and potato issues, I suppose, and it does really involve meat and potatoes. I haven't really, I guess there hasn't been a lot of movement in sort of the base issues like, you know, the price of food in the North, say, mm-hmm. or chronic levels of type 2 diabetes being a problem, or
poverty,
Indigenous people having massive high rates of tuberculosis. And of course, as we mm-hmm. keep painfully hearing almost weekly, the, you know, high Indigenous suicide rate, which I believe yeah. is 5 to 7 times higher than the rest of Canada, which is significant. Do you see, have you seen any movement in those areas? Because, I mean, I know that you would hope coming from the top, we see Trudeau with the chiefs and they have the little meeting and Trudeau gets a headdress and everybody's supposedly happy and that all looks great. But if you dig down a bit, you just need to watch APTN on any given day. To me, in terms of a news source for Indigenous issues, I think it's top drawer. Speaking as, you know, from the settler community. Every day, those issues are there and present, and there doesn't seem to be any movement unless it's kind of like the traffic light doesn't go in until there's a crash. Yeah. It's like there's a suicide of two girls, 12-year-old girls, and it's like it takes an independent person to cough up the cash to pay for that.
Yeah,
and
that phenomenal, should be coming. Really phenomenal.
That should absolutely be coming from the federal government under the, you know, under the treaties and responsibilities. Do you see any movement in that area? Like any movement in that area? Anything?
Yeah,
on the table?
I think you know, in this age, we expect instant results, mm-hmm. and instant results on poverty and social conditions. Some you don't get right. You have to build towards a longer term solution, and that's what. I mean, Perry Bellegarde is a good example of a very clever Indigenous politician, and he is playing the long game, right? So before the last federal election, they did a lot of work on a document called Closing the Gap. So all the things that need to be done over the long term to close the gap in, you know, health indicators and education and social conditions and so on. And so he's playing the long game, and he's putting pressure on, and the other leaders in the Métis and Inuit community are kind of in the same game. But, you know, politics is a short-term thing. So Trudeau is doing lots of things that are good. And, you know, look at their federal budget, for example. So there's they added $8 billion to expenditures on Indigenous communities. So that's set over 6 years, right? So
it sounds up from zero.
It sounds good. And Perry Bellegarde, again, he's playing a good long political game. He says, you know, this is progress, right? But, mm-hmm. and so on any given file, they back end loaded a lot of that money. So those modest, very modest increases in the right now. But and a lot of the money is after the next election. So
right.
there's a certain cynicism to the way they've constructed, but they are politicians, so they have to kind of play this game, right? So, I mean, in a sense, Trudeau is a conventional politician, and he has to balance a whole bunch of things. So, I mean, to give him credit, he's pushing all the right buttons, but he's balancing things. So, I mean, I think it's still a wait and see. The Indigenous community is diverse as any other area. So there's lots of very strident people who want to change things instantly right now. And there's a lot fewer people like Perry Bellegarde who are playing the long game. And those are valid perspectives. You've got to push in order to get action, right? But you need people like that to play the long game and ensure we got investment over the long term to change things, because closing the gap between, you know, all those health and social indicators is going to take generations, right? So, I mean, that's what I always say when we talk about reconciliation. It took us generations, a couple hundred years to get to where we are. It's going to take generations to get out of this with sustained interest and commitment. The sustained commitment is the hard part, right?
Right.
It's easy to, the Liberals have done a reasonable job of putting forward a pretty detailed agenda on Indigenous peoples and making a big, almost a sea change from the last government. But it has to be sustained over a long period of time. And I think, you know, the atmosphere has changed and public opinion's changed, and Truth and Reconciliation Commission has changed people's attitudes. You know, they did a poll last June and they did find a remarkable change in attitude. A lot of people had no idea about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission at all, but they had heard about residential schools, right? Mm-hmm. And that went into their heads, and they changed their attitude. So, like, now 90% of people support action to close the gap and to change the political system so it does redress past problems. So,
did you get the feeling we're at a bit, and I get the sensation, too, that we are at a bit of a turning point in terms of the relationship? Like that, mm-hmm. these things are now on the front burner, and I think you spoke about Gord Downie in your article too. Is that sometimes what it takes? Is this crossover of somebody who's involved with the community, but is also part of the, we'll call it the settler community, and writes that children's book specifically about an Indigenous person's life, and then it becomes on the radar. And in some ways, I guess it's unfortunate that happens that way, that you can't just sort of accept somebody telling the story. But I guess it doesn't matter as long as the story gets out there and everyone's on top of it. Then that's,
well, exactly.
I guess that's the goal, right?
Gord Downie is a good example of, you know, it's a crossover. And that he's an indicator of the change in sentiment and empathy amongst the mainstream Canadian community. And I think that's the case of lots of people across Canada are bringing, you know, First Nations and Métis and Inuit culture and thinking and peoples into the mainstream and doing things, you know, just like the city of Guelph, you know, they finally mm-hmm. are doing a territorial acknowledgement, and
that was quite amazing. They
helped pay for the Aboriginal Day's celebrations. And so there's been a change, and that may be as much a change on the Guelph city staff part. Mm-hmm. The council has always been fairly sympathetic, but the city staff attitudes change because they're changing, like the general population. Mm. Everything is shifting, I think, and it takes something to make the, you know, it's kind of social change is an interesting process, right? You got to have big events to move the needle, right? And that seems to be what happened in the last 3 or 4 years, and it does seem like we're on a tipping point, right? And we've got to cross our fingers and hope that sustained, because it isn't one of these things you can fix, you know, in a 5-year period because of the differential where we're at now and the huge systemic problems, right? I mean, it's not just racism, it's physical resources across the entire country. And, you know, this whole system has been designed or by neglect or whatever over 300 or 400 years. So, you know, the sustained interest is the problem. Right?
Can we? I just, you know, hearing you talk, it seems very hopeful. But then you turn on the news and you hear about, you know, more suicides on reservations. Mm-hmm. You hear about, you know, we just had the first anniversary of the incident at La Loche last week. And there's incredible urgency when we see these things. And you know, when you're talking about how it's going to take generations, and then you see these things and you think, well, is there going to be generations to reconcile this? To reconcile the reconciliation. Can you circle that square that just, you know, we have hope, but yeah. It almost seems like there's not enough time for hope that this will one day become.
Yeah, I often say it's an exciting time to be Indigenous in Canada, but it's not a good time to be Indigenous.
Mm.
It's really never been a good time in the last 300 years to be Indigenous. But it is exciting because it's about change, right? The hope and the excitement is about the change that could happen and seems to be coming. But you're right. I mean, the social conditions are unbelievably bad in lots of places in Canada, and the racism is bad. You know, McLean's, I think it was 2015, put out an issue, and the cover story was Winnipeg is the most racist city in Canada, right?
Mm.
And, you know, they didn't actually necessarily say they weren't either. They took that as an opportunity to try to do something about it, to get a group together and try to work on that. So, I mean, I think, but I guess I try to put a positive spin on it because, you know, I think that's one of the problems with the media and the general public's view of Indigenous peoples is it's always been a downer. And so they never wanted to think about it. So let's forget about that and move on to something that's more uplifting or something. Because I think, you know, there is a huge Indigenous middle class too, right? So there's a lot of people who have been to university or in positions of influence, in whether it's in the public sector, in the private sector, lots of entrepreneurs. They're doing good things like Lila Gilday and others. People are writing novels, and there's this explosion.
Tom King, who sat in that very chair that you're sitting in, pops to mind. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's an explosion of interest in the arts, to Indigenous arts. So people are pumping out books and CDs and recordings and plays. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a couple of plays on in Toronto right now, and so there's an explosion of interest from the general population in Indigenous culture and wanting to understand more. So there's a thirst for knowledge, I think that's really the first step of reconciliation is knowledge, right? So I think we're only really at the stage one, right? There's an interest and there's a change in attitude, but there's still a complete ignorance of, you know, who the heck are these people and what's their history, what's their culture, how to, you know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because I think the perception, honestly, of a lot of people is just the Indians. They don't get the finer points of, say, Métis or the Haida or Ojibwe or Dene. It's like that's a separate role unto itself, like the First Nations, but all of the nations. Like there's definitely nuance there that people don't get. It's
just
like,
I mean,
and those Indians. It's like, it doesn't work that way.
And Métis are official Aboriginal last year.
Yeah.
So that was a good news story.
Yeah, that's right. The Supreme Court said the feds can't dodge their responsibility.
And non-status, is that right?
Yeah.
Both, yes.
Maybe and non-status. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so if you asked the average person in Ontario, you know, what are the major Indigenous people in Ontario, what would they say, right? They probably wouldn't know. They wouldn't speak of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe and the Cree and a few others. They wouldn't know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they might think of the Haida because they're more well-known for art or whatever it is. They wouldn't have that answer. Or even in your area,
tattoo.
Right?
There's a Haida tattoo. So that's how we know. No, it's not how we know.
So looking forward, what do you think is going to be big? I mean, we've talked about the pipelines, but, you know, there's a myriad of other issues. What's the big issue for you think is going to be this year? What's going to be making headlines? Or do you hope that's going to make headlines, you know?
Well, I mean, I think there'll be the headlines, but I think it's also what goes on behind the scenes. So I think at the federal level and at the provincial level, we've got lots of good people working. Carolyn Bennett and the people behind the Trudeau government are doing reasonably good work, and so hopefully we'll see the fruits of that as it goes forward. I mean, there will be conflict around some of the resource management issues. no doubt about that. The big issues, and I think a lot of these will be kind of process things, like the murder and missing Indigenous women. You know, the commission, the commission of inquiry is there, but there a lot of their work is going to be when they go public with their getting input from people. That will probably be a very high profile issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
And Cindy Blackstock is the advocate who went to the Human Rights Tribunal last year. She won a case against the federal government that they discriminated against kids on reserve by funding them at a much lower level. And so she won there. And then the tribunal said the government hasn't complied because they haven't funded at the same level as the rest of Canada.
I've got to write the government actually at one point went after Cindy Blackstock, like actually.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It was in Charlie Angus' book. I think that's where I read it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like surveillance, and they were checking out her Facebook and page and following her around, and they had people
doxing,
tailing her, kind of, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she's a good case study of how things have changed, And now she won a case, and, I'm sure they fear her, as they should.
Yeah, she was the one that said equality needs to be the floor, not the ceiling. I thought that was a really good,
way to start
here, not up, and... So
her case will, because she's trying to enforce it. She's gone back to the tribunal to get them to issue. It's a kind of ironic thing. A federal agency is issuing an enforcement on the federal government itself to implement their own laws. So
would you say that, we are moving forward now in terms of nation-to-nation relations? I mean, there's been some debate, like, when are we going to, when is Canada going to approve the UN Declaration of Indigenous Rights and that kind of thing? But this isn't a situation where we elect a new government in a couple of years, and then we end up going backwards on Aboriginal relations. The direction now is forward, it feels like. There is momentum now.
Yeah, it is, yeah, and I think the Liberals have said that outright, and they've established different kind of ways of doing a kind of a nation to nation relationship, and they get full marks for that, particularly because they've done the research on that, and the province is doing very similar kind of work. So there's not, Ontario is pretty lucky in that regard that there's a lot of congruence between the two levels of government and how they're approaching Indigenous issues, but I guess the nation-to-nation thing is important, and that sort of government-to-government stuff and the government policies is important. But I think the other thing that's really happening that's interesting is within society. So things are changing within society. So I talked about the arts explosion. So people are interested, and there's a lot of activity. So, this Arts Everywhere festival, they had that Indigenous focus like they did last year. And so they're bringing speakers, and there's a big market now for listening, and a lot of people are listening to speakers like that and reading books. And I think that's maybe the most interesting part is the transformation of the social attitudes. And if that process continues, I think that will lead to further change in social attitudes and a raising of knowledge amongst the population.
Well, Paul, I appreciate you coming on because I always feel better about our relations with our Indigenous friends talking to you. So thank you for coming in and assuaging our white guilt. I appreciate it.
Remember, it's an exciting time, not a good time.
It's an exciting time, not a good time.
We're here for a good time, not an exciting time. No,
So thank you, Paul. And by all means, check out Paul's column in The Ontarian. And you can find that at theontarian.com. You can find us at opensourcesguelph.com. That is our website. We are also on Open Sources Newswire on Facebook, at @OS_Guelph on Twitter. And, of course, download the Open Sources podcast from Podbean. That's the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, and you can subscribe to us through iTunes as well. You can find me on Twitter at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to GuelphPolitico.blogspot.ca.
Scotty Hertz on Facebook, Scotty Hertz on Twitter, and the Spanner Book is becoming a weekly thing. Fancy. So,
ta-da! All it took was...
All it takes is coffee. Just add coffee and I'll write something. So.
And you can stay tuned here for DJ Sounds Good to Me here at the top of the hour on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. And we will be back here next week for more Open Sources, Thursdays at 5 p.m.